you know they're going to reboot something and they'll say, okay, you just do a cameo as the teacher and the
You never know. Anything can happen.
Hey, welcome back to a special episode of 1980s Now. Every week we chat about 1980s pop culture and its continued influence today. And this episode is only slightly different than our usual weekly show in that we have a special guest. We're going to be speaking with Lucinda Dickey. Hey, my name is Will. And joining me as always are my friends and co-hosts, Kat and John. Hey, guys.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
This is it's just really unique, you know, special kind of, I don't want to say, is it an honor? I guess it would be an honor sense, I guess, if peers said, hey, we recognize this about you, so we're going to do this. No, it's just weird sort of happenstance. And mostly it seems because she was a hustler during her early career and was, you know, and
put in the work. Yeah.
Put in the work and also was, you know, sought after. And, you know, we'll chat with her about how she got in these films, but no doubt it was ultimately because of her talent. But yes. what I'm alluding to is the fact that in 1984, which we're celebrating all year round, is the 40th anniversary of 1984.
All year round.
Yeah, just all year. We're celebrating the 40th anniversary of it. And not just generally. I mean, specifically the fact that there's certain pop culture that came out in 1984 that is worthy of praise having reached this milestone.
Certainly notable.
Yes. Talking about notable, as I'm bearing the lead here, Lucinda appears in three films in 1984. And now, you know, earlier this week, if you listen to our regular episode, we did a little game where we pointed out how some actors were in two films in 1984. You should check that out and test your knowledge about those movies. but Lucinda was in three. And maybe there's even someone else who's done that. But I don't think anybody's done this. One of the movies she's in is a sequel for a movie that came out 6 months earlier. That just
in the same year.
Mind-blowing.
Had to be a film that was greenlit just on the quality of the script of the first one, because no one could have seen the film before they even planned to do a sequel. And yet, of course, it was the heyday of breakdancing. So it probably helped to get those films made quickly while the iron's still hot.
Yes. And as John alludes to, we're talking about Breakin' and Breakin' 2 Electric Boogaloo. Yeah, you're right, John. I don't know how that was, because they had to be in production soon after the first one ended. And let's ask her about that. I don't know how soon they were able to decide. We certainly know that the first Breakin' film was a tremendous success. So had they been able to see the box office numbers, certainly that would have motivated it. But it seems like, did they even have time to do that?
Yeah, you almost... Know. That machine had to be working already, it seems like, right? Yeah.
Yes.
And good for her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she also starred in Ninja 3 The Domination, which is the third in the series of, in a series of ninja films that Canon Films was doing. They did a lot of ninja films. And you guys, I don't know if you remember, but there was a time before ninjas in America, and then we're living in the post-ninja world, right? I mean, there was a time in the 1980s, probably. Maybe the 70s, late 70s.
Yeah.
We didn't know what a ninja was, and then they were everywhere.
Yeah.
Is there one here now?
And like across all genres, there were comedy ninja films. There were action ninja films. There were thriller ninja films. There was cartoon Ninja Turtles. I mean, everything was a damn ninja in the 80s. And it probably sparked around 82, 83, right there at the beginning.
Yeah, and these Canon films played a role in that, by far ushering in this martial art, this culture from this Japanese culture into the zeitgeist of America, certainly, and ultimately the world. And Lucinda appeared in one of these films that played a role in that. Now, Kat, Lucinda in real life was a dancer who became an actor. And in the Breakin' films, obviously she dances. And in the ninja film, it relies on her, relies on her physicality. There's some aerobics scenes where she's doing aerobics, which is kind of more dancey. And certainly kicking people's ass, flipping around and doing that stuff requires some, you know, balletic, is that the right adjective?
Yes.
Ability. Kat, I happen to know that you share in common with Lucinda, both being a dancer and a ninja.
Oh, yes. Yes, we do have that in common. And I was just going to say, she has excellent taijutsu, which is body awareness. That's the Japanese word in specifically in ninjutsu for having good body self-awareness and balance so that you're ready for whatever's coming, ready to do the most efficient thing. So
I so wish we could have had somebody sneaking up on Kat right now to try to get her to show that she doesn't have taijutsu.
Her awareness. Well,
to test it.
To test my taijutsu.
So what is it called? Taijutsu?
Taijutsu.
Is it like feng shui for your torso, kind of? Like just always perfectly aligned and...
That's one way to say it. Yeah,
your shirt collar is a little askew, and so your...
My taijutsu is off.
Fix your taijutsu. Come on, adjust
just
that.
Buy another dream catcher, put it in the corner, it's fine.
Kat, the fact that you pursued dance is not surprising. A lot of folks pursue dance. Mm-hmm. What also led you down the path of becoming a ninja? And this is not a joke. Literally, you've studied ninjutsu.
I literally have studied ninjutsu. It was not something that occurred to me, but it was something that my now husband and then boyfriend at the time, he was and still is, big fan of ninjas since the 80s.
Oh,
like
it's all becoming clear now.
Fan of ninjas. Oh. And?
Like, oh, Kat, it'd be so hot if you were a ninja. What? Can you work this out for me?
Put this ninja gi on, these tabbies. Put these ninja tabbies on.
In fact, I would propose if you became a ninja. Oh.
The real story is so not as compelling.
So much more pedestrian.
Now I take this is going to get really I'm going to make it really blue for a moment here. So apologies to Lucinda. And now we take you to Kat and her husband's wedding night. Ah, Jukin! Ah, Tiryukin!
Those aren't nunchucks.
I've told this story before many times, and I'm not really going to tell the story.
Sonic Boom.
I remember how ninja culture, you know, affected my friends. You know, the fighting, you know, the fake fighting and some of the real fighting became a little more sophisticated.
You're going to tell me your friends got attacked by a ninja.
Yes, that's exactly. I was leading to that.
It affected my friends.
Mm-hmm. The rival ninja clan.
The gang, yes. The rival gang in our city. The ninjas. But my friends who are, you know.
You're a jet for
I had this one friend, you know, a good friend of mine who was studying martial arts already. Who now was becoming a ninja, you know? So his karate gi, now he had the hood too, you know, where other friends would make hoods out of t-shirts where you can look through the hole and tie it around your head.
Right, a slit. And
they had the shurikens. He had the nunchucks. Yeah, you know, all these things. I told you before how they would make fake smoke bombs using talcum powder.
Oh, Mitsubishi.
The car?
Yes, Hong Kong. You hit somebody with that, John, they're going down. I summon Mitsubishi.
You done brought a throwing star to a car fight. Yeah.
Now look, and we focus on the ninja portion of this because I think folks know already how much time we've spent talking about hip hop and breaking because I'm a big fan and it's something that I actually did in my real life as a kid.
Yes, which is awesome.
I know less about being a ninja, so I appreciate that. Yeah.
You still know less about being a ninja.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying.
In a crazy direction there.
I do fear they could show up at any time. All right, hey, with
that's
that.
That's how they be.
Yeah, so I'll probably focus more on my hip-hop history with Lucinda. But let's find out. Hey, we'll be back in just a moment with our guest today, Lucinda Dickey. Our guest today starred in not one, not two, but three films that premiered in 1984, the greatest year for movies. And our guest has the unique distinction of starring in a sequel to a movie that was released earlier that same year. Our guest's first film, Breakin', was a box office smash. Opening at number one, it danced circles around fellow new release 16 Candles. And knocked popular 1984 hits such as Police Academy, Romancing the Stone, and Splash from their long-held spots at the box office. In fact, Breakin' was the 18th highest grossing movie in a year filled with dozens of successful films, and it even outranked The Terminator. While our guests' other two films, Breakin' 2, Electric Boogaloo, and Ninja 3, The Domination, didn't fare as well at the box office, they've each since gained cult followings. And all three of the films were at the start of their respective trends that introduced hip-hop and ninjas permanently into our pop culture. Please welcome to the show, Lucinda Dickey.
Hi.
Hi. I've got to tell you, as long as I've been doing this podcast, which is a few years now, celebrating, examining 1980s pop culture, not just looking back and saying, oh, remember when, I like to make it smarter than that if I can. Sometimes I can't. And say how it's still important and relevant. And the films you were involved in the 1980s were part of two in particular cultural touchstones that are so associated with that era that their importance cannot be denied. And so I'm very delighted to talk to you. You've already elevated my show. There you go.
Thank you.
And not only that, and I've said this with no sense of irony, I believe 1984 was the best year for movies of all time. I mean, dozens of fantastic films, and we'll talk in a moment here about how one in particular of yours topped many of them to the surprise and delight of many folks. Ultimately, obviously, you're in these, you know, three films in 1984, which is really, I think that's got to be a record. And in particular, to have a sequel of one be to a film that came out early in the year. Has anyone ever mentioned to you that's been accomplished by anybody else? I can't think.
Not that I know of. But we literally rolled right into filming the second one. I mean, we had like a short little bit of time off. You know, we did our publicity tours and we were just right back at it. So, and I had filmed Ninja before I did both Breakin' movies. So a lot of people don't know that because it was actually released after. So yeah, it was one big, very full year.
Right.
Very, and I'm paying for it now.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah.
The body's paying for it now, you know, all those flips on concrete and, you know.
Yeah. And I guess just folks know about it, but at the point in this show, whether they're listening here, of course, we're talking about Breakin' and Breakin' 2 and Ninja 3. But you come to Hollywood. So look, I know your background is as a dancer, a trained dancer. Your mother was a dance instructor. You studied dance at university, and ultimately you make it to Hollywood on a dance scholarship. But I guess I'm thinking, when I normally think of dancers who are looking to pursue dancing, Hollywood's not necessarily where I would imagine they'd go, or based on my experience with friends that have pursued dancing. Maybe New York, maybe abroad. Why Hollywood?
Well, I actually went to New York first and auditioned for the Juilliard School. I was only 17 at the time, and I had actually never been on an airplane. So it was a big trip. I went with my mother, and I did the audition. You know, I feel like I did well. I was not accepted into the school. They felt like there were some other things that I should try and do first. Mainly, you know, I had done some pageants. I was in the preliminaries to the Miss America, you know, Miss Kansas pageant. I was in that 2 years in a row. And yeah, it didn't seem like a good fit for me. I was not ready for that. I had been out to LA once when I was about 15. So I had seen it and it was a lot less scary for me. Wow. And I just wanted to get out of Kansas. So, you know, it was like one, you know, coast or the other. And it just seemed like this was the better choice for me at the time. And it worked out pretty well. I moved out here in 1980 in the summer and immediately got on scholarship at Dupre Dance Academy. And that is really, it all just sort of started going from there.
Maybe being from the East Coast myself, and actually I worked at Juilliard as a composer for a couple of years for some of their shows. Hollywood seems way more intimidating. I've visited friends that work in the business in Southern California. Way more intimidating. New York, they're a little rough maybe, and there's a lot of them, but
well,
I can't imagine.
For me, Juilliard, you know, I mean, these are like ballerinas.
Sure.
And I, you know, my mother was my dance teacher. She opened a studio when I was 4 years old, and I grew up in her studio, and I learned ballet, jazz, tap, musical theater, a little bit of everything. But it was in no way in comparison to the ballet dancers in New York City. No offense to my mother at all. But it was just very, very intimidating. Sure. And California was, even though I, you know, took ballet class every day and it is the foundation for everything, it was just a completely different vibe. And it wasn't quite, not that it wasn't serious, but, you know, I was never going to be a ballerina, you know, that was not, you know, it just was never going to happen. So to me, this was less intimidating when I look at it from a dance perspective.
Right. Now I'm realizing there's something, so much of your, you know, your story, when you think of it just in these sort of like small digestible bits, is a Hollywood story of in itself. You know, it's almost, we can condense it to get off the bus, get cast in a film. But even this idea that you went to Juilliard as a dancer from the, I'm already picturing Flashdance, which of course Ninja plays a lot of homages to, even in that regard. But yeah, having worked in the theater department of Juilliard for a couple of years, they're really full of themselves. I mean, that's, you know, get over yourself. So you're interested in dance, obviously. You're in Hollywood dancing. What makes you become interested in acting? I mean, you know, folks on the outside might just sort of think of entertainment sort of as blended all together, but certainly even today, they're fairly, you know, compartmentalized, I guess.
Yeah. That's an easy answer, because my very first job after getting off scholarship, we were not allowed to audition during scholarship. They had very strict rules about that. And my very first job was Grease 2. I auditioned for that. It was a very lengthy process and multiple callbacks and always different people in the room every time I'd go back. But I was chosen as one of the 16 principal dancers. And we filmed for 3 months I believe it was in Norwalk, Excelsior High School, if I remember correctly. And it was a blast. I mean, of course, I knew a lot of the extra dancers. Some of the other principal dancers were from New York. Some of them had been in Greece. And just filming with Michelle Pfeiffer and Maxwell Caulfield. And, you know, I was like, I want to do that. You know, I just thought I don't want to be just a dancer. And, okay, you know, not that there's anything wrong with being just a dancer, but I just thought, you know, I had never really thought about it, opened myself up to that. You know, I really did come out to Los Angeles to be a dancer. And so, yeah, that's really where it all, you know, started. And when we finished filming, I joined a few cold reading workshops. And, you know, I mean, I was pretty much, I was very green. You know, when I was cast for Ninja, I mean, it was on a cold reading call. And I mean, I had no idea what I was doing, but I just went with it. You know, I didn't even know what that film really was. I mean, you go in, you get a piece of paper and I'm like, okay, I'm possessed by a ninja. Okay, sure. You know, how do you do that?
And it's a time where people didn't, you know, I mentioned it sort of being part of these cultural touchstones from the 80s. Ninjas was one of them, but not yet. I think we had maybe one other. Well, we had the couple of films that preceded Ninja 3. And I think there was an earlier film from the 70s, The Octagon, that had some ninjas in it. But other than that, this is the start of the ninja craze for the decade, where I know my friends were dressing up in, you know, ninja gis in the middle of Jersey City, New Jersey, making their own smoke bombs out of talcum powder. So I don't know how you could even wrap your head around what you're about to get into, because it's so much of it is unknown.
Yeah, it was definitely interesting, because I had auditioned for it and then left for a trip. I was actually, I can't believe I'm saying this, I was actually hired as a flash dancer for a private party in, I think it was in Des Moines, Iowa.
Oh, okay.
These are kind of the kind of dance jobs that you get.
Sure.
So I went away and did that. And then I stopped in Kansas to see my family. And I got the call literally like, say Tuesday, that I had a call back on Thursday morning. And so I flew back Wednesday, had the call back Thursday morning for Ninja. They cast me and I literally had that weekend to pack and get to Phoenix.
Wow.
So it was crazy. I hadn't read a script. I really didn't know any more than the scenes that I had read with. They actually, for the callback, they had, you know, several guys that I read with, you know, for the love interest. And, I just went on. I don't even think you can call it faith. It might've just been, I was just so naive. And I was like, I just got cast to star in a movie. That's all I cared about. You know, I didn't even care if they paid me.
Yeah.
They barely paid me. But anyway, So.
Yeah. And it seems like, you know, Canon wasn't what it would become. Again, you're getting in early on these things. You know, Canon had only been, it was Menachem Golan and Yoram Globus had just taken over Canon a few years earlier. It's ultimately going to have this impact on Hollywood, you know, by the end of the 1980s, Hollywood's going to take notice and think, we should do what they're doing. What are we doing over here?
Yeah.
But it seems perfect for you. Like what I've understood and talking to other folks who have worked on Canon films, it seemed like this kind of, you know, melting pot of this young energy and ideas, and that it would be perfect for someone who is as green as you.
Yeah. I think my saving grace, was two people, really. Sam Furstenberg, who directed, he was so kind and, really helped me a lot. And Jordan Bennett, my co-star, because I just relied so heavily on them to help me through, because I really didn't, you know, I had witnessed what it looked like because I filmed Grease 2.
Oh, that's
I was
right.
there day in, day out,
right.
But I hadn't done it, you know, other than my dancing parts, you know? So, and it was challenging, man. They put me in rehearsals immediately to train me to fight like a black belt. And I'd never taken karate in my life. So for me, it was learning new choreography. But yeah, I mean, it was fun. We kind, you know, you kind of become family on a set anyway, but when you're on location, and I was so young, I was 23 years old. Like we ate all of our meals together. I mean, you know, we did everything together.
Sure.
And, it was really a fun experience. I mean, I have very fond memories of it. It was kind of crazy. It was hard. But yeah, it was really quite the experience.
So you mentioned you were dancing in Grease. You observed Michelle Pfeiffer, Max Caulfield. Say, that looks like that's what I should be doing. That's fun and easy. But you also mentioned when you start doing Ninja, it's tough, but you also had a good time. Is it what you expected or had hoped it would be? Or was it quite surprising what it ultimately was?
You know, I feel like I really just put my whole self in it. And for me, it was a very physical role, obviously, because there was all the fighting scenes. As far as the acting scenes, I just did the best that I could do. I mean, I felt like I tried, you know, whether it was a part of me or Christy Ryder, you know, I don't know. I mean, I didn't really know how to get there, but I just did what I could. And I'm actually very proud of it. You know, I haven't seen that film in a really long time, but the last time I remember watching it with some friends, and they were like, "Hi, you know, you really were all, you were in it." Mm-hmm. Like, you know, so I felt like I accomplished something in that department. And of course, you know, that rolled right into Break-In. I actually heard about Break-In towards the end of filming, but I was kind of like needed to finish up what I was doing. Like, you know, I didn't have the foresight to like say, hey, you know, what about me? I dance, you know, and I actually had to audition for Break-In like everybody else. You know, I think they'd kind of thrown my name out there. They had another girl in mind who was more classically trained, if that's, you know, I suppose, than I was. And it was quite the battle when I returned to LA, because I'm just like, wait a minute, I just started a movie for you guys and you're going to not let me have that role. Like I'm a dancer, you know, I should be able to do that.
I was wondering about that. Okay. Yeah. And good. Yeah. You took it from the Juilliard woman too. Take that, Juilliard, classically trained, try to take your job. But yeah, I was wondering about that because obviously you had proven yourself to them as a hard worker and, you know, a great performer and dancer in particular. Yeah. That's amazing that they had you audition.
Oh yeah. I mean, open cattle call.
Oh, wow.
Like, this is not even like, you know, going into a room to read. Like I went, it was the dance open. Like I made up a routine that I thought was as close to break dancing as I knew.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a friend who we cleared all the furniture out of his living room and, you know, we practiced moves and, you know, I don't know if I did a knee spin. I did a butt spin. I didn't know that was, I think I did the worm. I didn't know anything about break dancing. We did, you know, Billy Goodson was one of, you know, he was the head of the scholarship program at DePraise. And he ended up choreographing the second one. But, you know, I had learned a few funky moves from him because he did, you know, sort of hip hop kind of, you know, jazz. But, I just threw in every gymnastic move that I had because I knew that was always my, you know, secret weapon because I could do aerials, I could do flips and not very many dancers back then. They're so much more athletic now. They all do it now. Mm-hmm. But back then there weren't that many dancers that were acrobats or gymnasts. So I just threw in as much of that as I could because I thought that's going to get their attention.
It fascinates me that, you know, you said you did what you thought breaking would be at the time, because most folks certainly didn't know unless you were in the culture on the West Coast or East Coast. It hadn't made it Midwest. It wasn't on TV very often.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I'm sure you realize this now, but you know, between Breakin' and Beat Street, which came out within a month of each other, I know Cannon was like, we got to beat Beat Street.
Yep.
but those two films really touched off, I know, in my neighborhood, where we already sort of knew a little bit about it, where we could watch, you know, sit in the theater all day long and learn moves, you know. So we learned from you, and you didn't know at the time you auditioned. You needed a break-in to be able to see it, to be able to learn it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and in the East Coast, we're a lot more gymnastic in there, even back in the 80s, than the West Coast, was, as you know, was a lot of the stuff was up on their feet. Did you find it when you ultimately are doing the film then and you're having to learn more hip hop moves, is it just natural to you because you're a dancer, or do you still feel a little bit like you're not part of that because you're working alongside, you know, Shabadoo and Boogaloo Shrimp, who are legit street dancers? You know, do you feel out of place even still?
Yeah. it was hard. Yeah. And the first rehearsal that I entered, when I met the guys, I definitely didn't feel like a welcome, warm reception. It wasn't, there was this, you had to kind of prove yourself a little bit,
sure.
You know, and Jaime Rogers was, you know, the choreographer, which was very loose because he really expected a lot of improvisation, but when you don't have all the moves, it's really hard to improvise that. Like I even had a hard time improvising in what I was good at because I was very structured. If you taught me 16 counts, great. I could learn it and do it immediately, but I wasn't real free. I was not, I just wasn't good at it. I mean, I actually sucked at it back then. Now I could do it. I improvise all the time, especially if I've had a drink or two. but it was hard. And I mean, they both did really, really work with me. Shrimp, Shabadoo, like we had extensive rehearsals where the only thing that I never really got down really good was the windmills. Mm. I bruised every bone in my body trying and learning. And I actually learned them after we had filmed, I think it might have been, it was after we had done Breakin'. We went on an international tour and I went with two other street dancers and the guys went to Cannes. That's another whole subject. But when we were going out to nightclubs every night and breakdancing in Hong Kong, Japan, we went to Australia. And that's when I finally got it because I was loose. I didn't have cameras in my face. Sure. It was in front of people that I knew I was never going to see again. You know, we were just out having fun. And that was actually when I finally started. I did head spins and crazy stuff, you know. Oh. None of it's on film, but that's okay.
Oh.
yeah. But no, it never was very natural for me. Nope. The locking, I mean, I tried my hardest. It was not a natural thing for me. Mm-hmm. I did the best I could. The waves, I could get a little bit.
Yeah.
I practiced in the car. I literally would roll down my window and let the wind take my arm.
Yeah, you know, right.
To try and get that feeling. And oh gosh, I mean, some of it in the film is very real, my struggle. But they also kind of dumbed me down a little bit because they didn't want me to be too good too fast.
Right. Sure.
So even in the montage scene, when the guys are teaching me in the movie, like, you know, there's some good stuff in there, but you know, they didn't want me to do too much. They wanted me to look like I was, you know, learning baby steps, you know, how to break dance. Right. So
I can see how the guys would be maybe initially, you know, you said it's a little awkward at the beginning because, you know, coming from that culture, it's protecting your moves, you know, like you don't copy anybody else's moves. I'm going to use these in a battle. So it makes sense to me, but of course, obviously you become part of the.
Shabadoo would say when we were in rehearsals and sometimes one or the other or both, they would just start going. And it was so incredible. We would be in like the dance studio going like, oh my God, it just comes. It's just whatever their bodies do.
Right.
But he would never do that like in filming because he didn't want to give away his best moves.
I knew it. I would have guessed that.
And I'm like, that was incredible. Why don't you do that? And he goes, I'm not giving away my best moves.
Yep.
Because then people would study him and learn him and be able to do them.
Yeah. And it's true. I was a kid growing up in, as I mentioned, in the city right across the Manhattan, right across the Manhattan on the Hudson River. It was like that. Now biting was, you know, verboten. It was looked down upon, but in order to evolve, you needed to have, you know, to build that vocabulary, like you're saying, to ultimately improvise and make it your own. So you were copying little things, including watching Breakin' over and over again, you know, in the theaters, like I mentioned, hiding from ushers. So you could stay in the theater a little bit longer. So look, folks you can't downplay the importance of Breakin'. It was number one at the box office. Ultimately, it's the 18th film in the year of 1984, the greatest film for a year for films, including beating The Terminator, you know, which is, at what point do you realize the significance of this film? Is it when you're getting box office returns or is it years later when you start to see how the dancing's catching on?
I have paid very close attention and I have a lot of memorabilia. In fact, I just found a stack of pictures in a drawer the other day that were Lucinda Dickey, Breakin', and I can't even remember. I think Robert Redford, there was The Natural, I think, came out that year too.
Yeah.
I think so. But anyway, so I have all these pictures of, you know, billboards and this and that. So I was very aware of it, you know, remaining top 10. I don't know why that even meant anything to me because I did pay attention to that. And what was so shocking is that, you know, we had that for the first one and then Breakin' 2 came out. Yeah, you know, it it didn't quite do what Breakin' did.
Sure.
And then Ninja came out and it was almost like the floor had just been swept out from underneath because it, as high as we rose for that so-called 15 minutes of fame and, you know, the box office and, the following that it's had has been so much greater than like the immediate after, because it really did just feel like, you know, wah, wah, you know, and that was hard. That was hard because I was now, you know, out in the competition going up against Michelle Pfeiffer, Demi Moore, you know, it was like, it was hard because I was a B movie actress, you know, to get to that A list was like, that just felt so out of reach for me. I tried, but it was just out of reach for me.
Yeah. And you know, as you mentioned, Breakin' 2 did not do as well, but it still made three times its budget. So it was a financial success by that account.
It was. And I don't mean to make it sound like it wasn't great because in some ways it was so much greater. I mean, I think they almost don't even compare. There were times that I would look at, even when we were filming, I was like, am I still the Kelly in the first one? Because the change was quite substantial. Yeah. So.
And the films themselves is quite a substantial change. The first one feels smaller and the second one is quite a spectacle and more of a fantasy,
scenes. And yeah, it was a lot different.
And of course you're reunited with Sam Furstenberg, who by what I read has a great talent for squeezing everything out of a budget so that even with a smaller budget, he can make this great spectacle. And then again, you know, make money because of the box office, exceeds that budget. What do you think about Breakin' 2's legacy now? You know, Electric Boogaloo has become a meme in the sense that people just add it to the end of anything they say is a sequel. You know, it could be The Shining 2, Electric Boogaloo. The funny ones are the ones that are incongruous.
Yeah. I don't know. For me, it's become very apparent to me. I almost hate to say this, but I feel like it was the guy's film, you know, because I think that the fans were really all about the break dancing.
I see.
And I know I was a part of it, obviously, and I was part of the story, but I never was that. And it wasn't meant to be. I was hired as I was, you know, a trained dancer that had to learn it. I mean, it was, you know, very true in that sense. So it's not like I know, you know, cause I've stayed, you know, in contact a little bit with Shabadoo and Shrimp over the years, but you know, for them, that's their world. Like they, you know, and it had different meaning for them, you know, and I understand that, but I don't feel like I'm the person that can propel that forward because
I see
that, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm getting that across right. But you know, I'm flattered that, you know, people still recognize me occasionally. They recognize my voice sometimes. But, you know, I always felt that it was a movie about breakdancing. You know, that's really, you know, the cult following.
It's kind of a curious thing that you make me think of because the folks that were cast opposite you were part of that world, it does create this kind of unusual circumstance where, like you're saying, maybe it seems more genuine for them or part of the continuity of their lives, whereas you were just a character. But if you take any movie like Grease 2, for example, which has its own, you know, unique sort of legacy. My wife loves that movie, by the way. that you don't even consider that because nobody really was a greaser or a pink lady. We don't even think of that. It could be a Michelle Pfeiffer film, you know.
Right.
But you're right. It's so I can tell you this much just as a fan, you know, from my perspective, who was a breaker on the street and, you know, part of that world was, I think of you as part of that. It's you guys, you know, TKO, that's a group, you know, obviously I know you're characters and I know they really dance like that in real life. But for me, the film exists on its own in a way that is important that I hadn't considered what you're saying, but I understand your perspective as the person who actually lived it. So, but that makes sense. Now, obviously, you do another film after that, Cheerleader Camp. I haven't seen it, to be honest with you. But I know one of our listeners, one of our listeners, Eric, wrote it's his favorite film. So I did read about it, but I'm wondering if part of what you're saying about the, sort of the way the films came out and how the box office seemed to be dwindling, and maybe you're now competing with folks that you didn't imagine competing with, or you long to compete with, but now the inverse of your success is maybe affecting.
You want to know why I did it?
Yeah. Well, that's not what I was going to ask, but yeah, please.
Well, it was kind of interesting because I had actually sort of stepped away. I had my son, who was 9 months old when I filmed that. And Gino Havens, who had been my very first cold reading class that I had ever taken, he was casting and he called me and said, "What do you think?" And I was like, "I don't know," you know. So I read, you know, read about it, and you know, I was like, "Well, I want to, you know, I want to play the lead part." And he goes, "No, you don't. Yeah. You don't want to do that. But I want to, you know, have you play the mascot." And I'm like, "All right," you know. I wasn't doing anything else. I mean, I just had a baby, and you know, I mean, maybe I'd been auditioning a little bit, but I was not really that active. And so I just decided to do it. We had a ball. My husband came up with me and, you know, helped with the baby. He actually has a role in the film too. And we were up in the Redwood Forest. Where were we? Camp Nelson, Redwood Forest. I can't remember where we were for like 4 weeks. And I have stories from that 4 weeks that I will never tell. I mean, we had so much fun though. I mean, you talk about roughing it. We were all in cabins. There was one little, you know, it was like the cafeteria, the post office, the general store. I mean, there's one place to go. We were in the middle of the mountains, and honestly, I had a lot of fun.
Oh.
Because, yeah. I mean, you know, I played the killer.
Right. Oh, spoiler. Oh, I didn't.
I did read that. I ruined it for you. I know. But it was fun. And, you know, my mother was so embarrassed that I had done that film that this is back when we had VHS, if you remember those.
Of course.
And she actually took the film, because she got a copy of it, of course, because I'm her daughter.
Sure.
And she stuck it in a sleeve that said "The Pope." It was a film about the Pope, because she was so worried that some of the grandkids might see it. And she knew they would never want to watch a movie about the Pope.
Right. That's funny. Yeah. And in those days, you know, I remember going to the video rental stores. The horror films always had the most intriguing, you know, covers on them that would just draw you.
You know, the original title was Bloody Pom Poms.
Oh, gosh.
No. Oh, gosh. Oh,
okay.
Yeah. That was the original title, Bloody Pom Poms. Mm. I was a little disappointed when they changed it to Cheerleader Camp.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Anyway.
That's curious that they would do that, too, because there's plenty of movies with bloody in them. You know,
so I know. Like
that was.
I know.
Not part of the. But I was wondering, what I was wondering though is, and thank you for sharing that, was whether or not not to downplay love and romance. I'm madly in love with my wife, but you pointed out how you met your husband while you're, you know, at some point after making your first or second film. And then it seems like your life takes a different trajectory. I'm wondering if that's enough to have you change interest in, or maybe not have a goal of being a Hollywood performer anymore, or is it part of this trajectory in the box office that you said you noticed maybe going the wrong way, all of the above, none of the above, that it seems like in short order, what you came to come to Hollywood to accomplish, your interests had changed.
Completely. Yes. Because after I had my children. I have a daughter also who came 2.5 years later. I loved being a mom and I really wanted to stay home and raise my children. And I would literally have panic attacks because I was still auditioning. I still did commercials, and for me to do a day or two job or a week even was fine. I was actually up for Days of Our Lives for a role and got to the screen test part. And I was literally having a panic attack because it was like, oh my God, if I get this, I didn't want it and I didn't get it. And it was like, I knew that it just wasn't for me.
Right.
It was stressful. I continued to do commercials for a long while. And then I even got bored with that because there's a lot of sit around and wait on set. And I'm just sitting there like I'm paying a babysitter and I'd really rather just be with my kids. And, you know, so that kind of just fizzled out too. And I have never regretted it. I have a girlfriend who, you know, she also had done quite a lot of, you know, film and television. And she's like, you know, Lucinda, why don't you, you could still work it. And I'm like, I don't want to. I just, you know, it was just something that I did. I loved it, but I don't need to go back and do it again. I'm been very happy and very blessed in my life and I'm good. I'm good with that.
In some sense, it seems like, you know, you had the, like the Hollywood experience just within, you know, 18 months or something like that.
Yeah.
And I can see almost it being enough. I get it. All right. But I understand the changing of perspective because it was a point where I was traveling, you know, every year to California, actually Southern California. And then my youngest daughter was born and I had a panic attack. Mm-hmm. She was only a few months old and I was in California and I had a panic attack because I felt too far away.
Yeah.
Like, what am I going to do? And my wife is completely, I have complete trust in her, but it's something happened and it stayed with me after that. I didn't want to go anywhere. Now she's older, so it's easier, but I get that entirely. Yeah. Well, so now your kids are grown. What did they think of mom as a Hollywood star for that period of time in your films?
You know, I don't think they've ever really been that impressed. I don't know. I mean, of course, you know, I think they've seen my movies. They've seen them, you know, I'm just mom, you know, I'm a big deal in the mom world, but you know, as far as that, you know, I don't think they really think that much of it. Maybe they're proud of me that I did it. You know, I don't ask them. We don't really talk about it that much. Although my son's wife had, they had gotten the Lucinda Dickey doll.
Oh.
Somebody had ordered it, somebody in her family, and she's shown me, and I'm like, I knew that they had them, but I don't even have that. I actually saw Ninja Doll too. Did you know they had those?
I did. You know, I did see the break-in one. Yeah, that's right. I saw a set actually where it's the three of you.
It's pretty ugly. Oh. Yeah, there's the three of us.
Yeah.
But it's hideous. I saw it, but maybe someday I'll order it on, you know, eBay. I don't even know where you get them.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, no, I don't think they're that impressed.
Well, the best compliment is that they're proud that you're their mom, of course.
Yeah.
You mentioned, you know, it might take a couple of drinks for you to start breaking in the family room there. But do you still dance today?
I don't anymore. And yes, I have been known to do some 80s high kicks after a few drinks. No, I don't
anymore. Without stretching first, Lucinda?
Hey.
Wow.
You know, it's pretty amazing what you can do when you're warmed up in another way.
Okay. Hey, there you go.
Okay. No, I have not been in a studio in quite some time. I did Sheila Kelly S Factor for about 10 years. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's pole dancing.
Okay.
And I had a lot of fun with that until I couldn't. Arthritis takes over. I'm 63 years old, everybody. And I just have to protect myself from myself. So I'm very active. You know, I have my dogs. I walk my dogs. I, you know, work out with a trainer. But yeah, I wish I still could, but body doesn't allow it.
It is amazing though, right? I mean, you're 63, you look amazing. You talk about the physical activity you keep doing. 63 is not 63 when we were kids. People that we knew that were 63 then.
They were dying.
Yeah. Yeah. We lost people at that age. Yeah.
I know.
It's something in short time that changed like that. Well, I appreciate your time. Lucinda, I've got a couple fan questions. If you got a moment, let's see. Jamie asks, he says that Rappin was supposed to be Breakin' 3. And he was wondering if this is his story. I know that it was part of the same universe, but, he's wondering if at any point you and the others were offered roles and declined, or was it always intended to be a separate standalone film?
Well, I don't know about that. I know that there had been a plan for Breakin' 3. I actually had a 4-picture deal with Canon, and there was a lot of conflicts after Breakin' 2 ended, and it got canned. It didn't happen. And there has been talk over the years. I've had people approach me even kind of fairly recently, but I just, you know, it just didn't happen. And so I don't know. I do think that Shabadoo may have had stuff in the works, but, you know, there was nothing really formed from it.
Yeah, and sadly, obviously, Shabadoo sadly passed away a couple of years ago. Pop and Taco passed away. I mean,
I know.
Both very young. It's sudden. It's terrible. Yeah. I've got another question here, and then I'll let you go. Let's see. Where did it go here? Peter asks, was there a situation or scenario that most surprised you to be recognized?
Oh, well, it's always a surprise because I never really expect it. The surprise is always that when people recognize me, I've just run to the grocery store or run out to do an errand and I look like hell. I don't have any makeup on. And it's like, oh, no.
Did you ever do the, I'm not her, but I've gotten that before. I've heard that. Yes. Can you keep moving?
No, I'm not a good liar. I can't. No. I actually did get recognized quite a lot when I was younger. It doesn't happen as much now. But now, like when I tell people, oh, by the way, if it comes up somehow, they're like, what? Because they know me from back then. And they're like, no way. So it's kind of fun. I actually went to a party a few weeks ago and met a couple of guys who would have been that generation below that went to the movie, you know, 50 times.
That's me.
And it was kind of fun to talk with them because, you know, when I said who I was, that, you know, they were like, oh, wow. And they had, you know, all sorts of questions. And, you know, so it's kind of fun. But yeah, it doesn't happen very often.
Lucinda, thank you so much. And seriously, sincerely, again, and I can imagine, look, you're humble enough to not necessarily have this really, you know, penetrate, but, you were in some very, films that were important to a lot of folks, around the world. And I'm talking about both Breakin' films and the Ninja film, which, you know, again, it was part of this, again, this phenomenon, these trends that were happening in the 1980s that are still important to folks. And you see how it, you know, 1980s pop culture continues to influence things that are happening today. And those films were certainly part of it. So I sincerely, on behalf of me and our listeners, I thank you for that. And I thank you for your time today as well.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
That was really cool. I've got to say, when I first started the show years ago, she was one of the first people I wanted to speak to. I did interview Michael Chambers a couple of years ago, and I never had the chance to speak to Shabadoo. And sadly, as I mentioned, he's since passed away. But Lucinda is definitely somebody who I've longed to speak to, and was super excited to be able to get the chance to do it. Hopefully, you couldn't tell how nervous I was. Did you break dance in the 1980s, or break, as we say, you know, as the folks in the know say? He let me know. Or maybe you were a ninja. Were you moved by that craze instead? You're still around. There may be one with you right now. I don't know. So grateful to Lucinda for appearing on the show and sharing her stories with us. You got an idea for someone else, of someone else you'd like to hear from? Hey, drop me a line, Will, at 1980s now, and we'll see what we can do. Hey, if you haven't tried yet, to listen to our episode that came out earlier, where I challenge Kat and John to name 1984 movies that are linked by one actor. See how well you can do. Having now listened to this interview, though, you're going to get at least one question right. Gosh, if you don't, I mean, that's on you. Otherwise, until then, on behalf of me and Kat and John, we will talk to you next time on 1980s Now.